ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 20th of February. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. Seismic, unprecedented, wild. These are just some of the adjectives royal commentators and ordinary Brits are using to describe the arrest of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, the King's brother, the man who is eighth in line to the throne. After spending the day in police custody, the former prince has been photographed leaving a police station in Norfolk. But police say he remains under investigation for misconduct in public office. Europe Bureau Chief Mazoe Ford reports.
As morning broke across the Sandringham estate, six unmarked police cars made their way to the home of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. By 10 a.m, a statement from the Thames Valley Police confirming they'd opened an investigation and arrested a man in his 60s on suspicion of misconduct in public office. The former Prince Andrew has spent the day in custody, while his home and his former mansion in Windsor have been searched.
What's your reaction to your brother's arrest, sir?
King Charles didn't respond to questions as he arrived at London Fashion Week, but had earlier sent out a statement.
What now follows is the full, fair and proper process by which this issue is investigated in the appropriate manner and by the appropriate authorities. In this, as I have said before, they have our full and wholehearted support and cooperation. Let me state clearly, the law must take its course.
Mr. Mountbatten Windsor is alleged to have shared sensitive documents when he was Britain's trade envoy with the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The former prince has not been charged and has always strenuously denied any wrongdoing. Royal commentator Afua Hegan told AM she thought today's turn of events was extraordinary.
I don't think we can really underestimate how seismic, how significant this is. We haven't had a senior member of the royal family arrested in recent times. When we use the word unprecedented, it's for occasions like this.
Dal Babu, a former chief superintendent with the Met Police, says the former prince would be treated like anyone else.
They could have invited him to a police station, but the decision has been made to arrest. You can be held for up to 24 hours, and then you have interventions from senior officers who can extend it up to 96 hours. So at this stage, I should imagine a decision has been made to arrest in order to access computer equipment, files, photographs, any other evidence.
Outside Buckingham Palace, fans of the royal family were pleased to hear about the arrest.
It's about time. It's good. Nobody's above the law. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it'll unfold and how history will unfold because of this.
We need to have people in power brought to justice in the same way that those who aren't in power are brought to justice.
Royal commentator Afua Hegan says public opinion will be important to the royal family as the police move through their investigation.
But let's remember that the royal family has survived scandals before, whether that's the War of the Whales, whether that's abdications, whether that's their links to slavery. The royal family have survived scandals before, and this is no different.
Which goes some way to explaining why King Charles went to Fashion Week and Queen Camilla kept her plans to attend a concert in Westminster. Keep calm and carry on, they say here in Britain. The royal family will be hoping they can do both. This is Mazoe Ford in London, reporting for AM.
The family of Virginia Giuffre has welcomed Mr. Mountbatten Windsor's arrest. Ms. Giuffre, who died last year by suicide, said she was trafficked by Jeffrey Epstein and forced to have sex with former Prince Andrew when she was 17, an allegation he denies. Virginia Giuffre's brother is Sky Roberts.
I think we're very hopeful that this is the start of the domino effect. This is where the house of cards starts falling. And, you know, kudos to the UK for taking the first step, for saying, you know what, we are going to arrest somebody who is held to one of the highest esteems out there, somebody who was a former prince.
British columnist Ian Dunt has also described the public response to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's arrest as somewhat optimistic.
The natural response is to say, well, look, isn't this a dark day for Britain? Isn't this a dark day for the royal family? You know, the brother of the king is being led away in handcuffs. But actually, there's this sort of oddly optimistic sense to it of thinking like, well, people do talk about equality and the rule of law quite often as one of the things you're supposed to be proud of in this country. And there's probably no better demonstration of that than what took place today. So people have although it's obviously a moment of crisis for the royal family, people actually have quite a strangely upbeat assessment of what happened today and a sense of satisfaction about it as well.
British columnist Ian Dunt. The Coalition is demanding the federal government revoke the passports of 34 Australian women and children linked to the Islamic State terrorist group. They've been trying to come home from Syria's Al-Roj detention camp, where they've been for the past 7 years. The Prime Minister says he has contempt for the group and will not repatriate them, while the opposition doubles down on its claims the government is helping the group return. Political reporter Sarah Temebska has more.
I'm going to do something really unparliamentary, and I'm going to call bullshit on this Prime Minister. You are lying to the Australian people.
The Shadow Attorney General, Michaelia Cash, not holding back as political debate over the fate of 34 Australian women and children stranded in Syria reaches fever pitch.
You are assisting these women and their children who turned their back on Australia to come back here. Do not treat Australians as mugs.
The accusations come as the government confirmed the group was issued single entry passports, which is the legal right of Australian citizens. Shadow Home Affairs Minister John O'Dunham says the passports should not have been approved.
Under the Passport Act 2005, the Minister for Foreign Affairs can refuse to issue a passport to someone who wants to compromise national security. And my argument would be, ISIS brides are a prime cohort for people who compromise national security.
Section 14 of the Passport Act states an official can refuse to issue a passport if they believe a person is likely to engage in behaviour that would threaten security in Australia or abroad. Professor of International Law at ANU, Don Rothwell, says the law is mainly applied to people seeking to travel out of Australia to commit terror offences.
Is there anything the government can do to refuse the issuing of a passport to a citizen?
Unless that person renounces their citizenship, no.
One of the women in the group has been issued a temporary exclusion order, or a TEO, to delay her entry into Australia based on ASIO advice. The opposition says the minister can act on his own accord to block the entire group. But Professor Don Rothwell says that's not quite right.
The minister really has to be convinced that an individual might be planning to promote an act of terror in Australia, and the threshold for meeting that would be exceptionally high. It would effectively mean that someone would have had to have been convicted of a terror offence in some other place outside of Australia, or they had a record of having sought to engage and promote acts of terrorism.
If the group does make it back to Australia in a self-managed return, Head of Intelligence Policy at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, Chris Taylor, says there are mechanisms to keep the public safe, including control orders.
That means monitoring, it means surveillance, and they are indeed all remarkably intensive in terms of resources. And this is at a time when there's a heightened concern about terrorism in the wake of Bondi. But I do think that Australian people should have confidence in institutions like ASIO, like the Australian Federal Police, like the State and Territory Police Services, who've been engaged in rather intensive counterterrorism activities for really 25 years now. But it is it's a tough job. There are difficult decisions and assessments that they have to make. They can never assure us of zero risk. And I think that's just something, in a sense, we have to accept.
Chris Taylor from ASPE, ending Sarah Temevska's report. The mayor of the region with the most concentrated Muslim population in the country has called for Pauline Hanson to face hate speech charges. Earlier this week, the One Nation leader said there are no good Muslims, something both the Prime Minister and New South Wales Premier have linked to another threat of violence against Lakemba Mosque. It comes as a bar owner investigated over satirical posters slams double standards in hate speech laws, as Annie Guest reports.
Southwest Sydney is home to Australia's most concentrated Muslim population. And the mayor of Canterbury Bankstown, Bilal El-Hayek, says they're hurting.
I'm not going to skirt around the issue. Pauline Hanson should be charged. It's an open and shut case. What she said was highly inflammatory.
Among other controversial comments, the One Nation leader said on Monday that there are no good Muslims, later giving a qualified apology. Mayor Bilal al-Hayek again.
When you look at the hate speech laws, they're quite clear. There is specific reference made of public incitement of hatred, discrimination or violence against protected groups based on race, religion or gender. Clearly, her target was clearly the Muslim people. And I have no doubt that her remarks will incite someone.
The Lekemba Mosque has received three threatening letters in 3 weeks, the latest a day after Senator Hanson's comments. The letter encouraged the killing of Muslims, praising the Christchurch terror attack where 51 Muslims were murdered. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, says there is a link between Senator Hanson's rhetoric and Islamophobia.
It legitimises it. It mainstreams it.
And the New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, says her comments may have inflamed tensions and contributed to the latest threat to the mosque.
We have to accept that words have consequences and that you can put hate in someone's heart with that kind of racist demagoguery of members of our community.
A spokesperson for Senator Hanson told AM she won't be responding to the Canterbury-Bankstown Mayor's call that she face charges. And Queensland Police isn't aware of any complaints. It comes as police investigate whether an ACT business has breached the new hate speech and symbol laws with posters depicting Donald Trump and several other world leaders in Nazi-like uniforms. David Howe owns Canberra's Dissent Bar and Cafe.
I'm still quite in shock over the whole situation, really. It just seems unreal that, you know, they've come along and deemed what are clearly satirical works of art an unmistakable anti-fascist message, offensive and had to be removed.
ACT Police is still assessing whether the posters are in breach of the hate speech and symbol laws. David Howe says it's ridiculous that he's being investigated for hate speech while Pauline Hanson is not.
I think that Pauline's remarks about Muslims and Asians before that, you know, far exceed the amount of societal damage that has been inflicted than me hosting a few blatantly satirical posters in my window.
And Canterbury-Bankstown Mayor Bilal al-Hayek says the law must be even-handed.
The law has to be implemented across every community, every culture, every faith in the whole country.
That's Canterbury-Bankstown Mayor Bilal al-Hayek ending Annie Guest's report. The US President Donald Trump has chaired the inaugural meeting of the Board of Peace, the body he set up to rebuild Gaza. The board was part of a peace plan for Gaza agreed last year, but the original vision appears to have morphed, with Mr. Trump today saying it could look over the UN into the future. Our America's editor, John Lyons, is in Washington. John, tell us more about the Board of Peace. What do we know about exactly what it will be doing?
Well, Mel, we're starting to learn more about Donald Trump's Board of Peace. It is a fairly opaque organisation. You have to pay $1 billion each country to be members. So there were 27 or so countries there today. Interestingly, some of America's traditional allies were not there. Canada, UK, France, Australia, for example, are not members yet. But we also learned that initially it talks about reconstructing Gaza. And President Trump said that the US will give $10 billion towards that reconstruction and that other countries will give $7 billion. But in terms of when and how it happens, it's still unclear some of these details. It's very much a Donald Trump organization. And he talked today about what will happen in Gaza or what he wants to happen in Gaza.
The war in Gaza is over. It's over. There are little flames. Hamas has been, I think they're going to give up their weapons, which is what they promised. If they don't, it'll be, you know, they'll be harshly met, very harshly met. They don't want that.
Donald Trump there. So, John, what did we learn from today's first meeting?
Well, I think we learned that this Board of Peace will be very much about Donald Trump. According to a charter of this organisation, which was leaked, he is the chair in perpetuity. So even after he's president, he's still chair. He can only be removed by, I think, a unanimous vote of the other members of the board. You have countries like Belarus and Saudi Arabia and others who have joined compared to those who haven't. But it was very much Donald Trump saying he hasn't won the Nobel Peace Prize. He brought that up again. He should have won it. He talked about how FIFA, the soccer organization, had actually given him a World Peace Prize, their first ever. Do soccer organizations normally give peace prizes? No. But he said he thinks they gave this because of the fact he didn't get the Nobel Prize. So it was very rambling in terms of what he wants us to achieve. But probably the key phrase that he uttered in the whole speech was the board of peace is going to almost be looking over the United Nations and making sure it runs properly. Now, the reasons countries like Australia and others have been reluctant to join is they think this is a way of supplanting the United Nations. In fact, in Donald Trump's own words, they will be looking over the UN. So that will not ease the concerns of many countries.
And what about his remarks about Iran? Because he addressed Iran and the efforts to try and get a deal with Iran in this speech too.
Yes, that's right. He said that he still urged Iran to make a deal on its nuclear program. He says if they don't, bad things will happen. And in terms of timing, which everybody's been interested in, because there's a massive firepower of US military naval firepower near Iran, he said you're going to be finding out over the next probably 10 days. So it does look like the clock is ticking in terms of Iran.
John Lyons in Washington there. A court case in the US could see Australian exporters refunded costs they've had to absorb if the Trump administration's trade tariffs are ruled unlawful. The consulting firm EY has found Australian businesses would be owed almost $1.5 billion depending on the outcome of the case. Alexander Lewis reports.
Robotic machines made in this Perth factory help to build homes in the United States.
Builders will send us a design file. Our equipment will cut it and help the builders to fabricate timber walls and timber trusses.
Ed Serrano is the managing director of the company Vector. He says America is its biggest market.
So the market in the US is roughly 10 times the size of Australia.
Foreign nations will finally be asked to pay for the privilege of access to our market, the biggest market in the world.
Last April, the Trump administration imposed so-called reciprocal tariffs almost globally.
We're going to have to go through a little tough love, maybe, but they all understand. They're ripping us off and they understood it.
Most Australian goods, including Vector's machines, were subject to a 10% baseline tariff. Mr. Serrano says the business had to partly absorb the cost, not to mention the loss of potential customers.
The direct cost to the business from those baseline tariffs is multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars.
The US Supreme Court is determining whether the president had the power to impose the tariffs under emergency laws. Lower courts have ruled he did not.
Legal analysts are doubtful around the powers under this particular legislation providing the president the authority to impose tariffs.
Luke Branson leads consulting firm EY's Oceania Global Trade Practice. He says the decision is possible when the court sits overnight, given the expedited schedule set for this case.
This particular statute allows the president to regulate imports, importantly, but it doesn't explicitly say that the president can impose tariffs.
EY modelling shows Australian exporters would be owed more than $1.4 billion in refunds if the tariffs are struck down. But Mr. Branson says businesses won't automatically get their money back.
Australian exporters won't just be entitled to the refunds, they'll have to go and seek them. And so it's incredibly important that Australian exporters are aware of that fact.
Even if the 10% tariffs are struck down, certain Australian exports are subject to larger duties under other US laws. And America is considering broadening those, which has companies like Vector worried.
Potentially a 50% tax on all industrial equipment. That's going to virtually destroy any chance of us selling our equipment into the US market. I can't say that I've seen much of a response from the Australian government.
Trade Minister Don Farrell did not respond to a request for comment. For now, all Australian exporters can do is hope the US judiciary delivers some reprieve.
Yeah, we'll definitely be watching the news and keeping our eye on that Supreme Court ruling.
Vector Managing Director Ed Serrano, ending that report by Alexander Lewis. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The disappearance of Nancy Guthrie, the mother of an NBC Today show host, Savannah Guthrie, is one of the most extraordinary in America's history. Today we speak to former FBI profiler Mary Ellen O'Toole, who spent her career studying the criminal mind, on the challenges facing authorities. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.